ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் டாட் ஆர்க், தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் முருகா காட் யோகா பார்ட் 2 அண்ட் 3 அண்ட் சக்சஸ் ஹாப்பினஸ் பார்ட் 1, பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க்யூ. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
In the Saivai tradition, there is a definite relationship between the worship of Lord Murugan and being successful in advanced yoga practices. Gurudeva describes it as follows. To attain even the permission to perform yoga, one must have the grace of Lord Ganesha and the grace of Lord Muruga. Lord Muruga is the god of the kundalini, of the advanced yogic practices. Unfoldment all happens within the kundalini and the chakras within our subtle bodies. Once a profound relationship is developed with Lord Muruga, then with the guru's permission and guidance, true yoga may commence. Otherwise, no matter how long one sits in meditation, no matter how hard one tries, it is just sitting. It is just trying. There is no fire there, no shakti, no power, no change. It is the gods who control the fire and at this stage help the devotee immensely, bringing him closer and closer to the supreme god, Shiva. Quite often the yogi in his deep internalized state may see and vision the feet or form of god Shiva before he begins to blend into the mind of god Shiva, called Satchit Ananda. It is God and gods in form that help us to find the formless God. End of quote. You can develop a close relationship with Lord Murugan, in which he feels like a good friend, if you take the time to get to know him through bhakti yoga. The practice of devotional disciplines, worship, prayer, chanting and singing, with the aim of awakening love in the heart and opening oneself to the deity's grace. Bhakti, to devotion to Murugan, can be increased or cultivated. Here are some specific suggestions. Number one, make the travel time to the temple a religious one. Don't allow yourself to focus on problems at home or work. Put on religious music in your car audio system and listen to it, for example. Number two, bring an offering. The act of giving opens you to the blessings of the deity. Never go to the temple without bringing an offering and giving it to the deity. Number three, put as much time and prana into the offering as possible. Buying a garland at the store is good, but making it yourself is even better. The prana in the offering, meaning the energy that comes out of your hands when you make the garland, goes into the garland, and therefore when the garland is put on the deity, it is like you touching the deity and creates an even greater closeness. Number four, during the puja, keep focused on the murti and the priest chant. Pay attention. Don't let the mind wander. When singing bhajan, keep focused on the meaning of the words. Fifth and last, the blessings, the shakti of the deity is stronger on some days than others. So attending the temple on the strong days is helpful to attuning oneself to the shakti. For example, there is a stronger shakti on yearly festivals such as Skanda Shashti for Lord Murugan. One of the disciplines that Gurudeva gave to his monastics many years ago was to learn to do the traditional temple puja, Paratha puja, for Ganesha, Murugan and Shiva. Therefore, all the monastics have had the opportunity to do regular pujas in our temple. Speaking from experience, we can all say that performing daily puja is definitely an effective way to deepen your personal relationship with Lord Murugan. Pujas can also be done in the home, the Atmarta Puja, and again provide an effective way to become closer to the deity. Lord Murugan is traditionally worshipped to invoke the forces of divinity to overcome the forces of darkness. Well, this is an important theme, so I'll repeat that sentence. Lord Murugan is traditionally worshipped to invoke the forces of divinity to overcome the forces of darkness. This process takes place both in the world and in the individual. It takes place through the power of his veil, which represents wisdom, or Jnana Shakti. Gurudeva often stressed that the world changes because the individuals in it change. In other words, the world becomes a more divine, peaceful place as more individuals find divinity and peace within themselves. And certainly the worship of Lord Murugan and his Shakti veil, his veil of wisdom, is a potent force in moving the world in this direction. Man's nature can be described as threefold: superconscious or spiritual, intellectual or mental, and instinctive or physical, emotional. It is the instinctive nature, the animal-like nature, which contains the tendencies to become angry and harm others. The goal is to learn to control these animal instincts, as well as the ramifications of the intellect and the pride of the ego, and manifest one's spiritual nature. This is the inner process within the individual of divinity overcoming darkness, and the regular worship of Lord Murugan helps us become a wiser person, better able to make these inner changes, and therefore make tangible progress on the spiritual path. Hindu icons in our temples all have mystical symbolism. A common symbolism is to depict the god as male and the god's energy or Shakti as his spouse. This is because in these temples they have Murugan with two consorts. So we have to explain the two consorts. God is everywhere seen as the beloved divine couple. Philosophically, however, the caution is always made that God and God's energy are one. And the metaphor of the inseparable divine couple serves only to illustrate this oneness. In the case of Lord Murugan, his consorts are Vali and Devayana. Additionally, we have the veil as an important symbol. These three represent three distinct energies, powers, or Shaktis. Vali represents Ichcha Shakti, the power of desire. Devayana represents Kriya Shakti, the power of action. The veil represents Jnana Shakti, the power of wisdom. Important insights into the soul's maturing process can be gained by looking at the three Shaktis of Lord Murugan: the power of desire, the power of action, and the power of wisdom, which are also the three powers of the soul. We first have a desire. When the desire becomes strong enough, we act. In young souls, the action may be ill-conceived and adharmic. For example, we want a computer, so we simply steal one. Money is needed, so we rob a bank. Soul is repeating a cycle of similar experiences, moving back and forth from desire to action, desire to action. In the case of the adharmic action of stealing, eventually the soul will learn the lesson that this is not the best course of action to take to acquire possessions. This learning is the Jnana Shakti, wisdom coming in and causing one's behavior to improve. This process also works for dharmic actions as well. We are helping out as a volunteer at the temple and teaching children's classes once a month. We like the feeling it gives us of helping others in a meaningful way and decide to help out every week instead, and even participate in the meetings which plan out the classes. We are doing a selfless action, and the reaction it has on us is to feel more inner joy. Therefore, the jnana is to decide to do even more of it and thus feel more joyful. We have again improved our behavior. We can see in both of these examples how it is that the soul undergoes experiences in the world with desire leading to action, desire leading to action, and eventually leading to wisdom and the improving of our behavior. This is the divine pattern through which our soul matures over many lifetimes, moving ever closer to God. Whether an action we have committed is dharmic or adharmic, the worship of Lord Murugan and the power of his veil of Jnana Shakti can help us understand the wisdom or lack of wisdom of our actions more quickly. In fact, some Murugan temples, the importance of the veil is stressed by the fact that the only murti in the main sanctum is the veil. Let's look now more closely at the process of learning from our mistakes. For all of mankind, no matter where one is on the path, spiritual advancement comes from improving one's behavior. Said another way, it comes from learning from one's mistakes. Unfortunately, this process is often inhibited by the idea that somehow we are not supposed to make mistakes. We grow up being scolded for our mistakes by our parents. Some teachers ridicule students when they make mistakes. Supervisors at work yell at others when they make a mistake. No wonder many adults feel terrible when they make a mistake. Therefore, to spiritually benefit from our mistakes, we need a new attitude toward them. Gurudeva described mistakes as wonderful opportunities to learn. He also compared learning from the experiences of life to progressing through the classes at a university. To quote Gurudeva, life is a series of experiences, one after another. Each experience can be looked at as a classroom in the big university of life if we only approach it in that way. Who is going to these classrooms? Who is a member of this university of life? It is not your instinctive mind. It is not your intellectual mind. It's the body of your soul, your superconscious self, that wonderful body of light. It's maturing under the stress and strain. End of quote. Those who are parents can teach their children that making mistakes is not bad. Everyone makes mistakes. It is natural and simply shows we do not understand something. Mistakes are wonderful opportunities to learn. The story I give to try and impress the point is of a young family. The wife is at home taking care of the five-year-old, and the five-year-old makes some horrendous mistake and almost burns the house down. So the wife calls up the husband and says, "Dear, you will be so happy to hear this news. Our son made this huge mistake today. He almost burned the house down. Isn't this wonderful? He has such a wonderful opportunity to learn such an important lesson, and I wanted you to think about it on your way home. What lesson do we need to teach him so he does not make this mistake again?" Of course, you all get the point, which is that unfortunately most parents don't think that way. Usually it is just a question of punishment. But punishment misses the point if it does not go along with the teaching so that you are helping the child learn how not to repeat the mistake. Helping to awake Jnana Shakti. Helping to awaken Jnana Shakti. Quite often punishment is all that happens, but the important point is the child does not know something. Otherwise he never would have made the mistake in the first place. There is some knowledge the child is missing, and the parents need to figure out what that knowledge is. It is fine to punish the child with positive discipline methods such as timeout and appropriate natural and logical consequences, and using reason without blame and shame. However, it is good to avoid the use of physical violence, anger, irrational punishments, blame and shame, as they all cause the child's consciousness to drop into intense fear, and therefore make it very difficult for the child to remember what he or she is told. This, of course, is counterproductive to the child learning from the experience and therefore not making the experience again. Moving on, we have four reactions to making a mistake. A common first reaction to having made a mistake is to become upset that we made the mistake get emotional about it, or if it is a serious mistake, to become quite burdened and even depressed. That is a natural first reaction. But if it is our only reaction, it is not enough. We need to deal with the emotional reaction to the action and move on to the learning stage. Thus, a good second reaction to a mistake is to think clearly about what happened and why the mistake occurred, and find a way to not repeat the mistake in the future. Perhaps we were not being careful enough, and resolving to be more careful next time will prevent the problem from occurring. Perhaps we did not know something, and now we have that knowledge, and can simply resolve to use that knowledge next time. Perhaps we created unintended consequences that caused significant problems to us or others that we did not foresee. Now that we are aware of the consequences, we certainly won't repeat the action. Those who are striving to live a spiritual life are self-reflective and learn quickly from their mistakes. In fact, one way to tell a young soul from an old soul is to observe how quickly he learns not to repeat the same mistake. The worship of Lord Murugan can be quite helpful in giving us the wisdom that helps us learn from a mistake quickly. The fewer times we make the same mistake, the faster we are moving forward spiritually. We can go to the temple and pray to Lord Murugan to help us understand the pattern of desire and action we are experiencing, and ask for his veil of wisdom to help us see clearly how to learn from this cycle of experiences and move forward on the spiritual path. Quite often I get an email in from someone who made a mistake, and they are saying, "Oh, I should have not done this." Of course, that is just getting stuck at the first level of reaction. I shouldn't have done it, I am sorry. But I encourage them to move on to the second level, and instead of saying, "I shouldn't have done it," to say, "I shouldn't do it again." That is the point we are striving for. Not to simply feel sorry that we made a mistake, but to commit to not making it again, or at least trying not to make it again. Taking that step is being self-reflective, and it is how we progress on the spiritual path. Because the spiritual path is a series of experiences, and sometimes we make mistakes, if we can learn from those mistakes and learn to not make them again, then we progress. If we are constantly making the same mistake over and over and over again, we are not progressing. A third reaction may be needed if the mistake involved other people. Perhaps we have hurt their feelings or created a strain between us. A direct apology can fix this if we know them well. However, in many situations, we are not close enough to the individual to be able to apologize. In that case, a generous act toward them can adjust the flow of feelings back into a harmonious condition. For example, hold a small dinner party and include them among the guests. A fourth reaction may be needed if the mistake is a major misdeed. For example, if we did something that was dishonest. In this case, even though we have resolved to not repeat the misdeed, apologize to those involved, we may well still feel bad about having done it. In this case, we need to perform some form of penance, prayaschitta, to rid ourselves of the sense of feeling bad about ourselves. Typical forms of penance are to fast, perform 108 prostrations before the deity, or walking prostrations up a sacred path or around the temple. The worship of Lord Murugan during the Thai Pusam festival is the traditional time for performing penance to atone for misdeeds. Carrying kavadi and other forms of penance should never be done for the purpose of impressing others. Rather, it should be done having in mind specific misdeeds you are atoning for, as well as promising to Lord Murugan not to repeat them again. One of the themes of this talk is that Lord Murugan is traditionally worshipped to invoke the forces of divinity to overcome the forces of darkness. And the process of atoning for misdeeds is an excellent example of this. Gurudeva describes this process from a mystical point of view. Quote, "When we perform penance and beseech Murugan's blessing, this merciful God hurls his veil into the astral plane, piercing discordant sounds, colors and shapes, removing the mind's darkness." Let me conclude with another quote from Gurudeva, which provides an excellent summary of the power of Lord Muruga's veil of wisdom. Quote, "The Shakti power of the veil, the eminent, intricate power of righteousness over wrongdoing, conquers confusion within the realms below. The holy veil that when thrown always hits its mark, and of itself returns to Kartikeya's mighty hand, rewards us when righteousness prevails, and becomes the Kundalini serpent's unleashed power, thwarting our every effort with punishing remorse when we transgress Dharma's law. Thus, the holy veil is our release from ignorance into knowledge, our release from vanity into modesty, our release from sinfulness into purity through tapas." Om Namah Shivaya. Good morning, everyone. Nice to be back at our Sanwan Homa. Shiva Homa and Kala Homa. Start the phase, start the week. So we have a talk that's somewhat new this morning. Success, a Hindu approach. In today's material world, success in life is popularly measured by looking solely at people's professional and family life. Do they have a good and well-paying job and a nice home with a well-educated spouse and intelligent children? If the answer is yes, then they are considered to be successful. We will take this as our initial definition of success, and throughout this article, deepen and broaden it in important ways. Parents are naturally focused on making sure their children are as successful in life as possible, which is good. However, unfortunately, some Hindu parents feel that their children's participation in Hindu religious activities and studies is a complete waste of time, meaning that it contributes nothing at all to their becoming successful. This attitude is based on one or more incorrect concepts, such as the following three. Hinduism encourages us to look at the world as unreal and thus take no interest in becoming successful. Hinduism is against the acquiring of wealth and the enjoyment of life. Hinduism's devotional practices and attending the Hindu temple are only for field and factory workers, and not for the highly educated professional. These three concepts are, of course, incorrect concepts, as Hinduism, when properly taught and properly practiced, definitely helps us be even more successful in life than we otherwise would be. Let's begin deepening our understanding of the Hindu concept of success by looking at the concept of the Purusharthas. These are called the four pursuits in which humans may legitimately engage, also called Chaturvarga, fourfold good, and are a basic principle of Hindu ethics. They are, as we know, Dharma, which is virtue, Artha, which is wealth, Kama, love, and Moksha, liberation. The achievement of the two goals, wealth and love, is identical to our initial definition of success. And thus we can see that Hinduism, contrary to what many Hindus believe, is in fact concerned with an individual's being successful in life. Said another way, wealth and love are the goals of all humans, including Hindus. Hinduism, however, is also concerned about how we pursue wealth and love. Do we do it in a virtuous and honest way? Or do we do so without virtue and honesty? Are spouses faithful to one another or not? Do we acquire wealth through honest or dishonest means? This is a concern of all the world's religions, not just Hinduism. Dharma, virtue, now enters the picture. Dharma is not totally a separate goal, but also governs the proper way to pursue the goals of wealth and love. Dharma also guides us not to simply hoard our wealth just for our own benefit, but rather to share it through acts of hospitality and giving. To elaborate a bit more, Dharma is the fulfillment of virtue, good works, duties and responsibilities, restraints and observances, performing one's part in the service and upliftment of society. It is the steady guide for artha and kama. Artha is material welfare and abundance, money, property, and possessions. It includes the basic needs, food, money, clothing, and shelter. But Gurudeva expands the definition to say that wealth required to maintain a comfortable home, raise a family, fulfill a career, and perform religious duties. He goes on to say the broadest concept of wealth embraces financial independence, freedom from debt, worthy children, good friends, leisure time, faithful servants, trustworthy employees, and the joys of giving, feeding the poor, supporting religious mendicants, worshiping devoutly, protecting all creatures, upholding the family, and offering hospitality to guests. Artha measures not only riches, but quality of life, providing the personal and social security needed to pursue kama, dharma, and moksha. It allows for the fulfillment of the householder's five daily sacrifices, pancha mahayagna, to God, ancestors, devas, creatures, and men. Kama is earthly love, aesthetic and cultural fulfillment, pleasures of the world, including sexual, joys of family, intellectual satisfaction. It includes the enjoyment of happiness, security, creativity, usefulness, and inspiration. And of course, we need to say something about moksha as well. Moksha, also called mukti, is freedom from the rounds of birth and death, samsara, which occurs after karma has been resolved and realization of the self-God has been attained. The desire for moksha only comes after a soul has pursued and been successful in dharma, artha, and kama for many lives, so that one is no longer attached to worldly joys and sorrows. Said another way, those who renounce the world in this life in the one-pointed pursuit of moksha do so because they have achieved success and fulfillment in the world in past lives. You may find it interesting to know that we regularly receive emails from devotees pursuing family life saying that their strong desire is that their dharma for next life will be to follow the monastic path in pursuit of moksha. That's always a nice email to receive.